Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we will take up topics certainly we have discussed before on this program, and that is the issue of global climate change. Most of the time, I think, when we talk about this, we look at it as a technical problem, which dictates a technical solution. But what we'll try to do with this morning's conversation is look at it in a little bit different way, and that is to consider climate change as an ethical problem. And the guest we have this morning is Michael Northcott. He is a professor at the School of Divinity at the University of Edinburgh, and he is particularly interested in looking at the relationship between theological ethics and the human sciences. He has written on a number of subjects, things like bioethics and genetic modification and globalization, and this one, global climate change. He is an ordained Anglican priest. He has been visiting professor at a number of institutions, including Dartmouth, the Claremont School of Theology, and Duke University. He is also active in the European Church's Environmental Network. He's authored a number of books, just to mention a couple, The Environment and Christian Ethics, and An Angel Directs the Storm, Apocalyptic Religion and American Empire. He is the author of a new book that deals with the subject that we'll be talking about this morning. The title is A Moral Climate, The Ethics of Global Warming, and it is just to come out. He is going to be giving a talk this afternoon on the U of I campus. He'll be appearing at the Author's Corner. This is on the second floor of the Illini Union Bookstore, and there will be copies of the book available if people are interested in having a copy and hearing from him. His visit here to the campus is sponsored by the Program for the Study of Religion. And let me mention one more thing. He'll be giving a talk. Again, this talk is on the subject Clouds of Witness, Religion, Ethics, and Global Warming. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. I want to make sure I get the time in there at the Illini Union Bookstore. Here this morning on the program, as always, questions are welcome. The number is 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. So if you're here in the immediate area, use that number. Otherwise, we do have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, as long as you're in the United States, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask callers to try to be brief so we can get in as many as possible, but anyone's welcome to call. Thanks very much for being here.
Pleasure.
Let's contrast these two views and then talk about what follows from each of them, starting with this view that says climate change, first of all, is a global problem. It's an enormous problem, bigger than probably anybody can really quite get into their head, a very big problem, but it is one that had a technological cause, so we shouldn't be maybe surprised if the solution is technological. Technology made the problem. Technology will fix the problem. If that's the way that you look at it, then what follows from that?
Well, it's certainly true that it is a technological problem. Really, I think in many ways, the beginnings of it go back to the Industrial Revolution, which began in my country, in Britain, when we started digging large quantities of coal out of the ground and invented a steam engine to pump water out of the underground mines to enable us to do that more efficiently. But of course, when we did that, we had no idea of what effect the carbon that was buried in the earth and has been stored there for millions of years would have when it went into the atmosphere. And it wasn't until the 19th century that a scientist in Sweden said, hey, if CO2 keeps the Earth warm by keeping some of the sun's emitted heat inside the atmosphere, particularly at night, so it stops us being like Venus, going from extreme heat to extreme cold. So if that's what CO2 does, then putting more of it in the atmosphere through the use of coal in houses and steam engines, and then, of course, by the 19th century, oil as well, that should make the planet warmer. And hey presto, 100 years later, most scientists now agree with this Swede, a man called Arrhenius, that that's actually what's happening. But then the question is, what do you do about it? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, putting it very simply, you've got to stop putting the stuff in the ground into the atmosphere, or else the planet will get too warm. to be habitable within maybe 300 years. And for certain people, it'll get too warm pretty rapidly, particularly near the equator. So in one sense, you can say it's technological. But of course, it's we use the stuff under the earth to drive our machines and our turbines and heat our homes and so on. But a lot of the things we do with that stuff are not things we actually need to do. So we don't need to drive big cars. We don't need to drive cars to do 10 miles to the gallon when we can build cars to do 80 or 100 miles to the gallon. Some of us don't need to drive as much as we do. We don't need to fly as much as we do. So there are quite a lot of things that we do already that we don't need to do. But the choice is about doing less of those things and doing and living differently are not simply choices about technology. They're also political choices and they're also moral choices. So if you understand that driving too much and driving large vehicles, flying too much, turning down the aircon and turning up the central air in the winter to keep the house warm, if you understand that shipping goods all around the world from China to the U.S. rather than making them here in the U.S. is actually making the planet increasingly uninhabitable for certain species like polar bears, but also for growing numbers of human beings, particularly, say, poor African farmers, then you might think, I have a moral responsibility to change the way I'm living. And so does my society. And that's not simply about technology. It's also about moral recognition that we owe people who our behaviors are affecting through the climate.
It seems to me that this gets at a central kind of question, that you might have someone who would, on the one hand, say, yes, I have come to understand this is a serious problem and it's a big thing and we need to do something about it. But I think sometimes it's difficult for people on an individual level to connect with it because they say, well, really, what's that got to do with me? Or perhaps they say, just me in my as one person in my life, well, what really am I going to do that's going to make much difference? Is it really going to make much difference if I either choose to ride the bus or drive my own car, or where I set my thermostat, you know, that those sorts of things. I think maybe sometimes it's difficult to get people to, as I say, to make a personal connection to the problem and therefore to the solution.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why in the book I try to describe what's happening to the lives of particular people around the world because of global warming. So I talk in some detail about what's happening to the Inuit or the folks we sometimes call Eskimos in the far north of this continent. I talk about Tanzanian farmers and how hard it is now for them to find grazing for their animals or even to grow their crops anymore. I talk about people living in Bangladesh whose homes are regularly flooded by the growing storm surges of strengthening storms that scientists believe are related to humanly caused climate change. Now, you're absolutely right, it's a global problem, and that makes it seem like there's nothing we individually can do about it. But I'm a Christian theologian, and I also study history, and I'm aware that in history and in Christian history, most of the really significant changes that have taken place, which have progressed our civilization, have begun through the actions of individuals and small groups of people acting collectively, and not through the actions of big government or corporations, the military, or whatever. So it seems to me that the moral responsibility is on individuals who see that there is a problem first to begin to change the way they're living, to create a kind of change in a moral climate where we're saying, actually, it is true that my carbon footprint, which here in the U.S., for example, the average individual's carbon footprint is around 20 tons a year. My carbon footprint actually is making, causing harm to someone else on the planet. People in Africa, their carbon footprint's about 0.2 of a ton of carbon. So it's there's clearly and yet they're the ones who are experiencing the worst problem. So we have a duty to act, and we have a duty to act first And many of the things that we could do to reduce our individual carbon footprint are actually not things that are going to harm us. In fact, they might even make our lives better. I mean, if for example, if we cycled more and drove less, even the pollution in our own streets would go down. We would get fitter. We wouldn't have to spend so much on maybe gym memberships, you know, or in the hospital, because people who are overweight tend to get more illness. And at the same time, we make our communities safer. People who walk and cycle out of their homes get to know their neighbors better. Cars that are not so streets that are not so trafficked are safer places for children to play and are more habitable places. So the point I'm trying to make in the book is that we need individuals to lead, to change the moral climate, but that also many of the things that we need to do to address climate change are things that will also improve other aspects of our lives and our communities, because it is about recovering a sense of moral responsibility for our material, environmental relationships. And so much of what the global economy and the consumer economy has done is to kind of take away from us a sense that what we does matters, that what we does have moral, that what we do, what we consume in our homes, what kind of food we eat, where the energy comes from, through the systems that bring it into our house, that any of that has anything to do with us. We have it, and that distances us from our lives, the material base of our lives. And I think that's a cause of a kind of political hopelessness, a sense that, well, I can't make any difference. It's all too big. I can't affect that. Well, I'm saying no. We've got to say we can, but we do that by starting small.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a car. We're talking this morning with Michael Northcott. He is professor of ethics at the School of Divinity at Edinburgh University in Scotland. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give some talks. He's authored a book on the subject. It's titled A Moral Climate: The Ethics of Global Warming. He's interested in the relationship between theological ethics and human sciences, and has written on a number of topics, things like bioethics, the ethics of food, genetic modification, globalization. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have some callers here starting to get lined up. We'll start with someone in Batavia, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Welcome to America, sir. Hope you enjoy your stay.
Thank you very much. I love this country. It's great to be here.
Thanks. I don't hear that from a lot of people nowadays. you know, my concern is I wish I could write a book like you on this same subject. I have taken college in this. A lot of my background's in forestry. I have a degree in forestry. And I'm from the northwest part of the country originally. And the studies I've had concerning, you know, back then it wasn't global warming, it was the Ice Age.
Yeah.
In the 70s. Geology has this way. We haven't, for one thing, we haven't been around this country. We haven't been around taking scientific knowledge and data for, it's been around 100 years, a little over 100 years. On what the country or countries are doing to each other as far as, you know, are we polluting or are not polluting. I know there's carbon dating in rocks because I've done it. I've worked with people that have done it. And there's other things out there that tells you what the climate has done over the thousands of years in this area. Now, I'm not saying that it isn't, we're not part of the problem, but I spent a lot of time, my summer times, working for the Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service, the government.
Yep.
And I could tell you we were probably our worst enemy. I used to take truckloads of garbage, you know, from campgrounds on a Monday and Tuesday after the people had been there. And we used to have signs saying, pack it in, pack it out.
Mm-hmm.
See, I fear more about the products that we put on the market today, like baggies and, you know, plastic this and plastic that, because of the lifespan, more than I do the cars. For the fact that I think there's more garbage out there that we produce as humans versus the automobile. And, I mean, there's a lot of things I can get into, and I know you have other callers in a short amount of time, but there, it's such a wide range of things that we are doing to this planet. It's incredible. Now, and I don't want to label any country you know, or countries bad, but I think the United States is probably one of the better people, the better company countries in this whole world than other ones, because I know it's a known fact that other countries pollute far more than we do. And I've been to other countries where they've been. It's in the water. It's where you walk on a daily basis or down the street. So I mean, when people want to label the United States as the bad guy, that's not true. I mean, you in comparison, maybe in the amount of people, but I still think we as general and the public have to work together to get the companies of this country, like the car manufacturers, to make them smaller, better motors. Make things last longer. It's starting to get there, but I think the money process is part of the problem. And I just was curious, you know, I would love to read your book and talk to you more, because I could go on with this. I mean, it's obvious because I'm on a rampage here. But having all my education wrapped up in natural resources, it's just overwhelming. And everybody wants to label one thing when it's a wider picture than that. I'll get off, and I want to thank you for being here. Thanks.
Right. Well, thanks for the comments. Your caller raises a number of good points.
You raise a number of good points. Let me take a few of them. One, how do we really know that we're the really crucial factor in climate change? People often say to me, you know, so far we've had like a degree Fahrenheit change. We've seen warming of the Gulf of Mexico, hence stronger hurricanes. We've seen some changes in the Indian Ocean. We're seeing changes in the ice caps. But such changes have happened before. What I would say is that if you look at the records of the climate of the planet that have come from the ice cores that have been drilled in places like Vostok in Siberia, those ice cores show very clearly that the change in the climate in the last 100 years is completely unprecedented in at least the last 500,000 years. So something is changing, and changing pretty rapidly. And the speed of that change is leading to a die-off of species. And within 50 years, at the current rate of climatic change, we could see 40% of species wiped out. So for someone like yourself, and for myself too, who's deeply concerned about forests and about what lives in the wild, that's a major concern. And I for myself, I think the science is pretty clear now that we are the main factor. Now, the question is, who is doing the most polluting? You said, and you're absolutely right, that in some areas, the U.S. has an exemplary environmental record. And if you look at things like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, then I would agree. Those, through pressure from environmentalists back in the 60s and 70s, through brilliant books like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the U.S. inaugurated a number of really remarkable laws which have made an enormous difference to pollution inside this country. But carbon dioxide is a pollutant but it's being named as a pollutant has been challenged by the present administration of the United States. But the fact of the matter is that in terms of that pollutant, the U.S. emits more per person than any other country on the planet, and furthermore has shown absolutely no intention politically or in terms of its corporations of reducing its output. And that is coming to be the most significant pollution in terms of the human impact on the Earth system of any pollutant that the industrial economy is putting out. Now, the position the American government has taken for the last few years is, hey, we're polluting some, but we still don't believe the science. And in addition, we think that other countries like China, for example, ought to come on board before we do anything. Well, the average American per person is producing 20 tons. The average Chinese is still only producing around 3-4 tons per person. So clearly that's partly just an excuse. But I would go further than that. I just came into this country yesterday, and I was driven out of Chicago across an enormous rail marshalling yard. Now, I know for a fact that many of the containers in that marshalling yard contain stuff made in China. Stuff that will be sold in Walmart and sold in, the malls all over this country. Now, the emissions of the factories that make that stuff, and the pollutants, indeed, of much of that stuff, are no longer appearing in America's skies or in America's rivers, but they're in China's skies and China's rivers. And so many of the emissions that the American government says, hey, the Chinese are emitting, a lot of those emissions are actually deferred emissions from the American economy. And so using China as a scapegoat, I think, is a terrible mistake. So I agree with you that America has, in some areas, had an exemplary environmental record. In this area of global warming, however, I'm afraid, I think that America has a really serious moral responsibility, because it is by far and away the biggest user of fossil fuels, and particularly oil, and the biggest polluter in terms of carbon dioxide of any nation on this planet.
Well, let's take another call. We have somebody here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Like the previous caller, I also have traveled in a couple of places where there was lots of trash in the streets, and it's easy to get the impression that, wow, people here sure produce a lot of trash, but I think the main difference is that here we produce all the trash that we produce gets hauled away once or twice a week.
Yeah, yeah.
Someplace where we don't have to see it anymore, and other countries aren't to the point where they have that service available. And then I had another thing I wanted to raise. I had an experience a few weeks ago where I took my kids to the park, and when we got there, there was a woman sitting in the parking lot in her SUV with the engine running and the air conditioning on, talking on the phone. Yeah. And when we had finished playing an hour and a half later, we came back to our car, and she was still sitting in her SUV with the air conditioning on, talking on the phone.
Wow.
And I was, told this story to a friend of mine, you know, being frustrated that here I try to ride my bike around as much as possible and hang my laundry out to dry and, make all kinds of changes to try to reduce my impact on the planet. And there she is talking on her cell phone in the SUV, and she just said, "Yeah, I see what you mean. She's not doing her part." And that just really hit home with me. I think that in a smaller group setting or in smaller societies, it's easier for people to hold each other accountable. But
yeah.
As you were saying, you know, it's easy to think, well, my actions don't have – I can't make a difference, so, you know, why should I make any effort? So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up, and I'll listen to whatever you might have to say offline. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
No, that's great. Thank you very much. It reminds me, actually, of a very similar event. I was walking a few months ago in the Rocky Mountain National Park with a very old friend, a man called Holmes Ralston, who's kind of the father of environmental ethics in this country, a great and distinguished scholar. And we came back down to, we'd gone up to see some longhorn sheep, which we managed to get to see. And they were a long way away, but we saw them. And then we came back down to the car park. And next to the vehicle we'd come up in, there was this enormous SUV, gray, big black thing. It was called an X-Terra, which was fascinating because it made it sound like a kind of extraterrestrial vehicle. And it was so enormous. It was almost like it could have come from outer space. And on the windshield of the vehicle, there was a sticker. And it said a Colorado State Emissions Exempt Vehicle. Now, my understanding is that that vehicle is emissions exempt because it's so big and so heavy that the federal government treats it as a light truck, and therefore not as a domestic consumer vehicle. And these light trucks have been sold by Detroit now for more than 20 years because they don't have to have so much pollution control on them. And that's been a way of getting around environmental laws. And America's corporations have, I'm afraid, been working pretty actively in the last 30 years to turn back the tide of environmental regulation by those kinds of devices. And we went from that little car park up to the Continental Divide, which is just a mile or two away. And there on the notice board, there was this other sticker, and it said, "Leave no trace." And it described, you know, the wilderness ethic of the park. And I just thought, well, that's how ironic that is, that you have these two stickers, you know. One says, you know, you can drive this 3-ton truck pouring out pollutants right through this park, and it's exempt from state laws. On the other hand, you're supposed to keep a kind of, there's this leave no trace ethic. And I think that America's great with its wilderness areas, and it's great at conserving those. But making the connection between conserving wilderness and producing and having an economy which conserves the earth as a precious, as I believe, a precious divine creation. That, I think, is a connection that many Americans don't make. And I think it's a connection we urgently need, so that we don't just kind of fetishize or set aside beautiful wild bits of nature, but that we actually see that every aspect of our material relationship with the planet requires us to steward the planet and respect the planet and respect the creator who made it. And I have to say to you that I think many corporations have been hand in hand with the government in the last 20 years in this country in trying to undermine that careful stewardship and respect that environmentalists for a long time have been calling for.
We're in a midpoint here, and we have several other calls we'll get to in a moment. But for anyone who might have just tuned in, I do want to introduce again our guest, Michael Northcott. He's a professor of ethics at the University of Edinburgh School of Divinity. He is an ordained Anglican priest. In his academic work, he's interested in looking at the relationship between ethics, theological ethics, and the human sciences, and has written on a number of subjects, including bioethics, the ethics of food, genetic modification, globalization, and other things. He's taught a number of places, including Dartmouth, Claremont School of Theology, and Duke. He's also active in the European Church's Environmental Network. He is the author of a number of books. His most recent is A Moral Climate, The Ethics of Global Warming. He's visiting here at the campus. His visit is sponsored by the Program for the Study of Religion. And he'll be giving a talk this afternoon, 4 o'clock, on this subject here at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. That's on the second floor. There are copies of the book available, will be copies of the book available, and I think maybe then it will be a bit more widely available in the U.S. a little later on this fall, although I think that you could go to Amazon if you're okay with Amazon and get a copy that way. Just quickly here, and I hope that the callers will not mind if I ask you to talk about one other thing, because I think it's interesting and worth thinking about and talking about, and that is the idea that within various faith communities, there is a tradition that says that the health of the environment can be taken as a measure of the moral health of human beings. Mm. It's in a sense a barometer of our own moral condition, and it seems that you're making this argument that says we need to get back to, or to recognize that there is that kind of connection.
Absolutely. And it's very widely spread, actually, through the Old Testament. And the guy who is strongest on this connection is actually the prophet Jeremiah. And he makes it very clear that changes he sees in the landscape in the times of ancient Israel have come about through the excessive demands of the Hebrew monarchy on the land, by putting too many animals on the land, trying to extract too much resource in terms of food from the land, and by rich people taking too much for themselves and not leaving enough for the poor. And so the Old Testament makes it very clear that when a society is unjust, it also tends to wreck its environment. And in a way, I think global warming is a judgment on the larger injustices of the global system that we're now participating in, which is seeing more and more of the Earth's resources brought from nations in the South into countries like North America, and indeed into Northern Europe, where I live. We are benefiting from a continuing post-colonial extractive economy. And of course, that it's the very movements of resources and goods and the deforestation that economy is generating, which is also reflected in the growing problems we're having with the climate.
Well, let's talk with some of the folks here. The next caller in line will be Gibson City. This is line two.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Yes, I am really enjoying your hearing what you have to say, and I have to agree with you both as a human being and theologically. I love my country, but I think as the number one power in the world, we need to set the example, and I think the people in power that had the opportunity to do this have dropped the ball, you know, for the most part. But I also want to tell that lady that talked about the lady in the park. I think one person can do something, and one turned into many people, and I think that's where it's going to be, grassroots. And I just came back from Canada, where the First Nations people, the Algonquin people, are fighting to keep uranium mining off their land. And I don't know why it is, but it seems the people in power think only of the mighty dollar, and that really saddens me. And as a Christian, I guess my faith comes in there, and that's not where it's at. And sharing with everybody, and it seems like instead of sharing it with the poor and making sure they get fed and clean water and health, we're going in the opposite direction. And I want to thank you so much, and I hope to read your book, and I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to hear from you. What you just told me reminds me of something I heard in New Mexico this summer. Before I went to Colorado, I went to New Mexico this summer, and there the state government is trying to persuade First Nation peoples on the reserve to have built another coal-fired power station. Now, the power station that's there already causes particulate emissions and pollution and has caused illness, including leukemia, amongst the children of the people who live on that reserve. And the deep irony is that New Mexico has so much sunshine that if it used one of the new technologies that there is now out there, which is this solar collection technology, which involves the use of mirrors, and you concentrate the light of the sun on a big tank of water, and then that tank heats up and it drives a big turbine, New Mexico could generate so much electricity using that technology. It could export that electricity to other parts of the United States. But somebody, and I guess it's people in big coal and in the state government, have decided they'd rather pursue an old technology, which is not only damaging to poor people living near that technology, but that it is damaging to the planet. The point is, many of the solutions to global warming are better for us as well as better for the planet. They will make our local environment healthier as well as the global environment. But our moral climate and our corporations, and sometimes, I'm afraid, also our politicians, are tied into an understanding of a different kind of economy, a fossil fuel-driven economy. And they still think that's how to get rich, that's how to get wealthy, that's how to raise more taxes. And I'm sorry to say that's just not the way to go. We need leadership, not only from individuals, but from politicians. You do have some courageous politicians in this country who have given leadership, but many, many others have continued to question the science and have continued to oppose action, including on Capitol Hill, as well as in the White House.
Let's go next to another call. This is Savoy, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Well, you answered one of my questions halfway, at least, already, talking about Jeremiah. Is there anything in the New Testament about the topic?
Well, that's a good question. Jesus says at one point, you know how to read the sky at night. But you don't listen to my words, and you don't change your lives. I'm paraphrasing, but he makes that reference to the fact that people can read the weather. And I think it's quite interesting that he uses that as a way of saying, but you can read the weather, but you don't respond to what God wants of you. And so I think that there is something in that for us about climate change. Clearly God wants from us to live more peaceably on this earth, to live in ways which don't involve the kinds of levels of waste that previous callers have been referring to, and to live in ways that are respectful of the poor and of our other than human neighbors, the other species that God put on this planet as a sign of God's generosity and beneficence. But we are still choosing as a civilization not to live in that way. So we are beginning to read the signals from the weather, but we're not seeing those signals as having moral and spiritual implications for how we live our lives. And that connection that Christ makes, I think we still need to make.
Well, I don't know what it's like over in Scotland and England, but it appears to me that in the United States there's a very large effort amongst many of the talking heads on television to denigrate the national roots in Judeo-Christian background for this country. So, you know, it seems to me that while you're speaking in terms of the moral value of paying attention to some of these things, I think there's a tremendous part of the American electronic media, at least, that is moving the population as rapidly as they can in the direction of atheism or anything related.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I wish the people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, who are telling us that God is not great or that God is dead or that God was never there in the first place, would at least own up to the fact that religion has been a major source of much of what we value in our civilization, and continues to be a source of behavioral change and of moral concern. Some of them do, but I don't see this in Dawkins and Hitchens. I really don't.
I
think that's tragic, and I think it's also an issue in environmental terms. And Edward Wilson is another person I greatly admire in one sense, but he also is pretty down on religion. But he at least recognizes that religion generates wonder. It generates respect for the creation, and that scientists ought to find a way in their own narratives, at least of finding some way of generating that same kind of wonder. But I as a theologian would say, well, yeah, actually, maybe it's just not possible purely by describing the appearances of things, as science tends to do, to generate that, the same sense of wonder as you get when you actually see those appearances as a material emanation of the divine. And to me, that is a much more powerful account of why this world is valuable and why we ought to respect it.
Yeah, I do have a clarification type question. Did you say a little while ago that because America is consuming so much and we're ordering so much of these things from China, that we're indirectly responsible for all their pollution methods as they generate and make these things that they're going to sell to us?
I certainly do. I mean, let me bring it right home. I mean, I have an Apple computer. I bought it here in the States. But I know that Apple computer, though it was designed in California, was made in China. That means the emissions, not just the CO2, but other pollutants like the fire retardants that I know are being put in that machine, for example, those fire retardants polluted rivers in China. They did not pollute rivers in America. And that is why it's cheaper for the Apple Corporation to make computers in China than it is here, because China has weaker laws. Now, you might say to me,
that's the problem of the Chinese.
You might say that to me, but America is quite happy to use China's weak regulatory environment, both in relation to labor and the ecology, to make most of its stuff there now and not here. Now, I would say to you, I think we should be bringing some of that manufacturing back home again. But of course, then the corporation is going to say, oh, but it'll be more expensive and we don't want to do that. Well, that to me will be responsible corporate behavior.
Yes. Well,
I really, I hope the caller again will forgive me. I really need to jump in here because we have other callers I want to try to include, give them some time too, and we just have about 10 minutes left in this program. Again, let me reintroduce the guest, Michael Northcott. He is professor of ethics at the University of Edinburgh School of Divinity. He's a theologian. He's an ordained Anglican priest. He's author of the book A Moral Climate, The Ethics of Global Warming. Next, let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line one.
Hello.
Yes.
I have two things to say, and that is, first of all, that I'm so very pleased and relieved to hear you say that the earth is a divine creation of God and that we need to respect it and be good stewards of the earth. And I don't think very many people say that, think that. And then the next, another thing is that President Bush always used to say that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Well, I think we, the people, this human race, are the weapons of mass destruction of this earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also saw a car in the parking lot at the grocery store with the engine running and nobody in it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I expect they were running the air conditioner.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, you tempt me into another area. I mean, I wrote my last book was on the Iraq War, and frankly, the untruths we were told, but in Britain, as well as here in the U.S., about what got us into that war. But the tragedy is not only have the latest survey done by conventional statistical survey method, a household survey, where they interview households right across Iraq. That survey showed more than a million violent deaths reported since the invasion. That is not a victory. That is a tragedy for the Iraqis, and it's a tragedy for Britain and America. And, of course, what drove that war, frankly, was not Saddam Hussein. I mean, the regime in Burma or in Zimbabwe.
Well, my point trying to get across is that we are weapons of mass destruction
on the earth. Well, I was going to get to that. You see, what I think drove that war was oil and the politics of oil.
Oh, yes.
And the point is that what's behind global warming is a larger problem, a systemic problem with our economy. We think we have to be at war with one another and the earth to extract the resources that will keep us rich and keep us wealthy. This is just not true. The Christian message is fundamentally that God created this earth to be a peaceable place, and God calls us to live in peace. The heart of the message of Jesus Christ was to call people to live in peace, to reconcile, to forgive. And this nation claims to be, far more than my own, a Christian nation.
Yeah.
And yet it is at war, both with the planet and with people in many, many places, more than 800 bases around the world. And the climate, the carbon footprint of the American military. I hate to think what that is. The last point you make about us being a weapon of mass destruction. Well, of course, as a theologian, I find that a troubling metaphor. James Lovelock, in his book in his various books on the Gaia hypothesis, suggests we might even be like a virus on the planet. Now, I mean, I believe that we were called by God to live on this earth and to offer praise and to work through the creation to enable all creation to praise God. Now, if that's the case, we're not a virus. We were made in the image of God in order to bring glory to the whole creation and to God. That we are failing to do that is partly because we think we need to be at war rather than pursuing peace to secure what we think we need to keep our civilization going. And that is a great tragedy.
Well, thank you.
All right, to another caller here. Someone in Champaign, it's our line four. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I tuned in late, so you might have talked about this, but I have two points I want to bring up. The first has to do with the two callers back, which I heard you make earlier and I heard you make again, saying that the Chinese pollution is really sort of American pollution offshore. And I, as someone who was recently in China, I would like to disagree most strongly with that. A large part of the Chinese pollution, and especially the air and water pollution, has to do with China's production for the Chinese people. And for the 1 billion plus people that are in China, use of coal power as the primary source of electricity for China is evident in the skies, in the air of China. I spent 2 weeks in China and traveled in the north, and only one day for a few minutes did I see a blue sky.
Yeah, I've heard this from friends as well. Yeah,
and
yeah, it's shocking.
So I would disagree strongly that the amount of auto traffic, et cetera, all in China. This has nothing to do with the rest of the world. And the production for China. So I think to put it off on the United States or any other countries is really dishonest and is really showing a prejudice that you have and an unwillingness to look at the responsibility of China for China. So
well,
that's one part. The second part, it has.
Can I respond to that? Quite a complex point. British accountants have done a study, which measures the global CO2 emissions of the British economy, principally, obviously, our corporations working overseas, and they've found that those emissions exceed 5 to 1 all the UK land-based emissions.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, 5 times our CO2 footprint is being generated offshore than onshore. Now, if that's true of the British economy, we're a global trading nation, but so are you.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true of us, it's for sure true of the United States. Now, the figures from the IPCC make it quite clear that the U.S.'s carbon footprint is 25% of the world's industrial carbon footprint. That's way in excess of China's current contribution. Furthermore, per person emissions between China and America, Americans are emitting around five times per person what the Chinese are emitting. So I just do not think we can get away from the fact that the biggest responsibility for addressing climate change is those nations that are emitting the most. And those are U.S., Taiwan, Canada, and the northern European nations like the one that I come from. And furthermore, we have a historic responsibility for the vast quantity of the carbon that's already in the system, which is now taken up by, particularly by the ocean, which is more and more replete with carbon, and the atmosphere. So it isn't just present emissions. You've also got to look at historic emissions because they stay in the Earth system for hundreds of years. This gas just doesn't go away.
Yeah, but I want to broaden it. I don't think the carbon emissions are the only issue, and I think the pollutants that are very evident in China, and you could just see them in the air. It's like the L.A. in the 60s and 70s before there were any pollution controls, but it's like that all over northern China where I was.
The second part of what I want to say then is that I completely agree with you that China has its own problems. Part of it is it goes back to the same problems they had in Eastern Europe. You don't have democracy in China, and so people are suffering from government decisions to allow pollution to drive an industrial economy, but their suffering doesn't impact upon government because government's not elected. And they had the same problems in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe towards the end. And it was actually environmental pollution, which was one of the main causes, ultimately, of communism collapsing in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. So I'm totally with you that China has an enormous problem in terms of its internal industrial pollution, and it needs seriously to regulate its industry, or it's going to make its country uninhabitable, to say nothing of the tide of cancers and bronchial problems and asthma and so on that they are already having, that the Chinese people are already experiencing. So I'm totally with you. The Chinese have to do something, and they need to act fast. After all, they want to have the Olympics, don't they? Isn't it in 2012 in Beijing? And I hear that even in Beijing you can't see the sun most days. So you know they're going to have people going from all over the world, athletes running there who won't be able to breathe clean air because there ain't clean air in Beijing right now. So I disagree with you on one hand, but I'm agreeing with you on another. China has political issues which it needs. And it needs to address its own environmental problems. But the United States and Europe cannot use China's carbon emissions as an excuse for not leading on this problem. We are much richer than the Chinese. We still pollute five times as much per person as they do. And our corporations are very active in polluting in other parts of the world, including China.
If I can just make one point, then I'll get off. This is the shift. I recently read that it's not only the American automobile companies that are fighting the reduction of emissions, et cetera, but it's also companies such as Toyota, which surprised me, is even though Toyota has all these wonderful cars such as Prius, et cetera, they're also fighting increased government regulation and emission standards, especially given that they produce cars that meet these standards in Europe and in Japan. So I think this is a matter of corporate and global corporations not cooperating, and I think that's an issue that needs to be taken up globally in terms of corporate policies.
Yeah, I entirely agree with you. ExxonMobil in this country has funded a great deal of really weird science trying to deny global warming. Car companies have a consistent record of arguing that any pollution control on their products will totally destroy their industry. Do you remember when they used to say that, lead, it's not... I mean, for years, the car companies said lead wasn't even a pollutant. and that it didn't harm children's brains. And then the car on the oil company said it would be too expensive to take it out. You know, I mean, they have done this consistently, like the tobacco industry. And we just have to face the fact that if we are going to allow our politicians to receive the amount of corporate dollars that they do, however, they will not challenge the kinds of lies that the corporate public relations departments put out about their activities and about how government environmental regulations will destroy jobs and destroy their products and destroy markets. There is a long history of this, and you're absolutely right. We need to challenge it.
We need to stop. I'm sorry to say that because we are here at the end of the time and we have a call that we can't take. My apologies. But I do want to mention again that our guest for this hour, Michael Northcott, will be talking more on this topic this afternoon at 4 o'clock. He'll be appearing at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. This is on the second floor, and there will be copies of his most recent book available. It's A Moral Climate, The Ethics of Global Warming. He's here visiting the campus. His visit is sponsored by the folks in the Program for the Study of Religion. Our guest, Michael Northcott, is professor of ethics at the University of Edinburgh School of Divinity. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.